But
you know it. I'm going to say it, and you're going to go, fuck me to death.
I don't know if I'll say that. Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From San Diego, California, you are Keith Foster.
That's right, and with me, as always, is Cassidy Robinson from Los Angeles, California.
And today we're going to be talking about A Quiet Place, and at the end of the program, in our Netflix homework, we're going to review Girlfriend's Day, a Netflix original. So, I guess we began the tradition last week of a, what have you been watching this week? Which I didn't realize until I was listening to the most recent episode of The Listening Party, that they've kind of fit in a sort of similar segment at the end of their show, where they talk about other stuff they've been consuming other than music.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of podcasts do that. So don't feel like you're stealing too much.
Somebody's stealing from somebody. Somebody originally did this, and it was very clever once upon a time. But what have you been watching this week?
Well, it's not something I've been watching. It's actually something I've been listening to.
Okay.
I just finished listening to Michelle McNamara's book on audiobook, I'll Be Gone in the Dark. She's Patton Oswalt's late wife.
Oh, that's depressing as fuck.
Yeah, it is. But it's really good. It's a true crime book. It's about her obsession with finding the Golden State Killer, who has yet to be caught.
Okay.
And so it's pretty fucking horrifying for most of it. But then every once in a while, there's chapters that are just, like, completely devastatingly depressing.
Right.
It's heavy. It is a heavy book, but, man, it is so good.
Okay. That's cool.
I don't do a lot of, like, true crime books. I do listen to a few true crime podcasts, but, yeah, I can't imagine many being better than this. It's real good. But listen to it during the daytime and maybe take some long breaks in between, because you'll start to think everyone's a fucking rapist. Well, what about you? What have you been consuming?
So this week, as a lot of people know, I haven't really watched TV in like 5 to 10 years. But I do consume a lot of YouTube. That is pretty much my TV. And there's a new
waste.
There's a new web series that's by a guy named Rick Beato. I don't know if you're familiar with Rick Beato. He's a record producer and music teacher out of Atlanta. He does a series called "Why Is This Song Great?" where he goes over the music theory behind popular rock songs over the, you know, however long, from the 70s to through the 90s and now. It's really cool. You know, I know nothing about music theory. I know nothing about, like, how that stuff actually works. It's all, like, magic to me when people start those, like, numbers and letter conversations about music.
Sure, yeah.
Or the blah, blah, blah diminished and those kind of terms. But I'm endlessly fascinated by it, and it's cool to learn a little bit about why songs that we've always appreciated and taken for granted work on a structural level. He does a lot of other kind of videos, too. It's not just that series. That's a series among a lot of other series he does. He also does a lot of things with his kid, who he taught perfect pitch to from the age of a baby.
Oh yeah, I saw that.
Yeah.
Do you think this will be practical knowledge for you at all? Like, are you going to use it to try and make music or something?
No, absolutely not. I just find it entertaining. Way too late for me to ever, like, I don't know. I guess I could, like, learn how to play something at this age if I wanted to, but it would take way more concentration than it's worth.
I guess. I mean, you could just do it because it's something you're interested in.
Yeah, who would do that, though? Okay, so...
sorry, this podcast... I feel like this episode's starting off real, like, grim and dark. And we need to, like, lighten it up a little bit.
Okay. Well, hopefully your game is going to lighten it up. You had a game you wanted to play with me.
Yeah. I don't know that I have a name for this game. We'll just call it, we could call it Keeping It Fresh.
Okay.
We could call it Farming Tomatoes. I don't know. I'll describe the game and maybe you can help me come up with a name, or maybe our listeners can name it if we decide to play it again later.
Okay.
So I'm going to take a movie that was either pretty well reviewed or pretty poorly reviewed. And I'm going to read you a review of a dissenting opinion. And I'm gonna blank out all of the things, like all of the specific names. And sure. You have to try to guess what movie it is based solely off of the review.
Okay.
So if it was a really highly rated movie, I'm going to read you one of the splat reviews. And if it's a really low rated movie, I'm going to read you one of the fresh reviews.
Right, and by reviews, you mean the blurbs on the front page.
Yeah, just the little
sound. Not like the full, like, 600 to 900 words.
Yeah, just the little blurb.
Okay.
All right, I'm going to start you off with an easy one. Or, hopefully easy. I guess this will help me gauge how easy this game is. This film has achieved some notoriety for the cultural climate that Hollywood is experiencing at this time. If Hollywood wanted to nominate a woman, they could name Eliza Hittman or Catherine Bigelow.
Lady Bird?
Yes! Ding, ding, ding. Correct.
Okay.
That was Ernesto Diaz Martinez review.
From what outlet?
Reforma?
I don't know it.
Yeah, it took me a little while to find a negative review.
I mean, there are a couple.
Yeah. Okay, so that's Lady Bird. You got that one right. This one might be a little harder. Do you want the year the movie came
out? Yes, please.
Okay.
That would help greatly.
Okay. Director Blank takes one of his... this one's weird, worded a little weird. Director Blank takes one of his most beloved historical incidents and transforms it into a McDonald's product. The year was 1997.
Titanic.
Yes! Ding, ding, ding. that was Felix Vasquez Jr.'s cinema-crazed review.
Alright.
Yeah, I don't know if I need to give him shout-outs.
He probably doesn't write for that outlet anymore, and the outlet probably doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, his review was written in 2012, so... Yeah. Aimed at the kids, but provides a few chuckles for the adults, too. Aimed at the kids, but provides a few chuckles for the adults, too. The movie was released in 2011.
That's a little difficult, because that's sort of a sloppier year.
Yeah.
I'll give you another hint. Nondescriptive... review.
Yeah. I'll give you one more hint.
Okay.
I think this might be the only certified fresh review.
For this particular movie.
Yeah.
Aim for the kids, but provides a few chuckles for the adults too. 2011? Oh, geez. Where was I in 2011? is it... No, that would have been way before that.
Just say it.
No, it was, okay, is it... God damn. I keep thinking of something, and then I realize that's, like, years and years before that.
Just say it.
No.
There's 10 of these total, so...
Jesus Christ.
Yeah,
probably right didn't need to do that many.
Right now, you have 2 points.
Okay. I'm gonna say, is it some crappy DreamWorks movie? Monsters vs. Aliens.
I'm sorry, no. This was for Jack and Jill. Starring Adam Sandler. Yeah, that one's misleading, because I don't think that was a kid's movie.
No, I don't think that was aimed for kids, exactly. I think it was just aimed for idiots.
Yeah. Oh, okay. There was one more positive review. That one might have been a little better. Whatever. All right. This one also might be a little vague, but it's more recent, so it should be
okay. Easier.
If we can't believe in the characters, how are we supposed to care? Would it help if I say this is a splat?
Well, I can tell that it's a negative comment. What year?
This one was 2017.
So recently.
Yeah.
Can't believe in the characters, then why should we care?
Yes, if we can't believe in the characters, how are we supposed to care?
Okay. I mean, that could be a lot of movies.
It's definitely a movie you saw.
No, I'm sure it is. 2017.
Okay, here's another one that's similar. Same movie.
Okay.
I felt nothing for the characters, which makes the premise of rooting for the misunderstood a moot point.
All right. Yikes. 2017. Okay. Is it Get Out?
No. This was for Shape of Water.
Oh, okay.
All right. This one, even more recent. This one came out this year.
Okay.
Blank doesn't quite have the originality and spark to make it a pop culture phenomenon, yet it's still an enjoyable family adventure with a solid message.
Blank doesn't have the spark or originality, but still a solid movie or something to that effect.
Yeah. This is a positive review for a largely panned movie.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm always reading you the opposite.
Okay. This is a much more difficult game than you realize. I started off very strong. Also, my memory is terrible. I'm trying to think.
I think a few of these might be a little easier than I'm giving you some hard ones right now.
Right. So that is this year. Not that many movies have come out. Have we seen it?
No. We did not see this one.
We did not see this movie yet.
God, no. No way I was going to see this.
Oh, Jesus. Okay. You've been hinting like crazy, but I can't for the life of me think of anything that's come out like that, like a kid's movie in the last few months. Oh, I mean, surely there were a bunch. But
you know it. I'm going to say it, and you're going to go, fuck me to death.
I don't know if I'll say that. I keep wanting to say something like Emoji Movie or something like that, but I know that came out like last year.
Yeah, but you're on the right trail. Think of something just as stupid.
It's not Boss Baby. It's not Nine Lives.
Nope, you're thinking of all of last year's stupid
All of last movies. Year's bad kids movies.
Oh man, it is right in front of your face.
Was there a Smurf movie that's came out this year? Oh, no, it's Sherlock Gnomes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like I had to give you that one.
You kind of did a little bit, yes.
But I'll still count it. I'll still count it.
Okay, let's do two more and call that good.
Okay. Here, I'll do three more.
Okay.
Blank is a simple story about video game nerds who get a chance to save the day.
Okay, that is...
But the movie came out in 2015.
Video game nerds who get to save the day.
Yeah.
A 2015 movie, negative reviews. Or no. Oh, hmm.
Blank is a simple story about video game nerds who get a chance to save the day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Pixels.
Yeah!
Okay.
Ding, ding, ding. All right. Two more. The results are shocking at times. Fuck that one up. The results are shocking. At times, borderline sadistic, but effective. Like the musical score, which resembles a chorus of anvils, Blank pummels the audience into submission. This came out in 2016.
That is a lot of verbiage. For, I'm guessing, a largely negatively reviewed movie.
Yeah, yeah. This one, I feel like, has some pretty good clues, though, if you think about them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Is it the last Transformers movie, the one with the Transformers The Last Night or whatever it was called?
Is that your official guess?
I guess, yeah.
No, I'm sorry. This was for Batman v Superman.
Oh, okay.
The results are shocking, at times borderline sadistic, but effective. Like the musical score, which resembles a chorus of anvils, Batman v Superman pummels the audience into submission.
Was that reviewed by Zack Snyder's mom?
No. Eli Glasner? I don't know.
He
looks like a dork. All right, last one.
Sure.
For good or ill, Blank is the soul of a new machine, the poet of post-human cinema, the CEO of Hollywood's military entertainment complex. This came out in 2011.
That damn year. All right, read it again.
For good or ill, Blank is the soul of a new machine, the poet of post-human cinema, the CEO of Hollywood's military entertainment complex. You know this one.
I think you are tricking me. Is this the third Transformers?
I don't know. It's I'll give it to you. It's Transformers Dark of the Moon.
That was the third one. Four. Yeah. That was the last one I watched.
So all right.
I did okay. Right.
I think you still won. Yeah, you only missed, like, three.
Three out of, five or six?
There were more than that. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. There were eight. We got through eight.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
There was a stretch there where I was starting to kind of worry about my life. But then I kind of picked up again.
All right. And that was...
whatever we want to call that game.
Guess the movie.
Splat or...
not to splat. Help us, listeners.
Name that segment.
That or splat.
Let's go ahead and get into the movie reviews. We are doing that this week. And we're going to talk about A Quiet Place first. This just came out, and I didn't know until I was looking up the information on it last week when I was trying to figure out what we were going to watch, that this is the directorial debut of The Office star John Krasinski, who also stars in the movie.
Emily. Yeah, you didn't know that?
I didn't know that until kind of recently, yeah.
Yeah, I knew that.
Okay, Jay Leno.
Every motherfucker knew that.
Oh, no, now you turned to Eddie Murphy. Okay. You went from Jay Leno right
into Eddie. Every motherfucker knew that. I'm a donkey. I was Jay Leno at first.
Yeah, you started
everybody Jay knew Leno. That John Krasinski did that.
So yeah, this is
you can cut those impressions.
I'm going to keep all of them. So this is directed by John Krasinski. This is his directorial debut. And speaking of Michael Bay, which he came up a little bit in our game we just invented, this is put out by his boutique horror studio Platinum Dunes, which is pretty much specializes in terrible, overblown, overproduced Hollywood remakes of classic horror films.
Interesting.
As well as the Purge movies and a few other things, but really, he was the one that they were the company that did the Jessica Biel Texas Chainsaw. They did the remake of Nightmare on Elm Street, the remake of Friday the 13th, the remake.
Oh shit!
Yeah, that is.
I thought the Purge movies were Blumhouse.
It might have been a dual thing. I'm not sure. But yeah,
did I tell you I saw the first Purge movie.
No, you didn't.
Finally. Yeah.
We'll
talk about that another time.
Maybe we save that for the opening. So yeah, this movie is an original idea, I suppose. Written by Brian Woods and Scott Beck, worked on the screenplay together. And it takes place in a future where we don't get a ton of explanation as far as what exactly happened, but what we do know is that the Earth is pretty much just occupied by survivors, and John Krasinski and his family, his wife Emily Blunt, playing Evelyn Abbott, John Krasinski playing Lee Abbott, they have three children, and they're trying to survive as best they can in a world that's overrun by monsters who have super sensitive hearing. So if they make any noise at all, if they speak too loudly, if they drop something, whatever, these monsters are quick-moving and can snatch them up and eat them in a moment's notice if they make too much noise. Other than that, they can pretty much get by.
I think all that you really have to do to sum up the rest of the plot is there's a bit of a time jump, and mm-hmm. Emily Blunt is pregnant, and so they have to deal with how is she going to give birth.
And I didn't think about this until it happened, but like, babies are loud, yo.
Oh, I thought about it. Birth in general is loud.
No, yeah. I mean, there's that scene in the trailer, everyone's seen it, where she's huddled, where she's, you know, giving birth in a bathtub, and she's trying not to make a sound, and you know that this movie is going to be selling you a lot of intensity just from that scene. And it's a sequence that really pays off, but it's part of a larger set piece that kind of extends through the second half of the movie. It really kind of builds on itself, and kind of comes back around every time it loops, it adds something new to the stakes until it gets higher and higher and higher. I should mention Millicent Simmons plays their oldest daughter. She is a deaf actress, and I know there's been a lot of stuff in the media about how John Krasinski fought to keep her in the movie.
I guess he said that casting. So the character, their oldest daughter is deaf,
mm-hmm.
And that's a huge plot point.
Yes.
And the characters all communicate through sign language. And,
yes.
Though John Krasinski.
She's the only one that has to speak in sign language.
Yes.
Which kind of gives this family an advantage over other survivors, because they can communicate pretty quickly with each other without having to use words.
Yes, but also, you know, it gives them a disadvantage with her, because she doesn't know when she's making noise, really.
Right, and her hearing aid is on the fritz, and it's a whole thing, but, you know.
Well, she doesn't have a hearing aid that works for her.
Right, right.
So.
Krasinski's working as hard as possible to get that fixed, but yeah, I'd be interested to hear what you had to say about this movie.
I have a couple things. The first most obvious things I need to get out of the way,
mm-hmm.
is that I feel like podcasters would be fine in this dystopian future, because we all have soundproof rooms that we can hang out in that are very well insulated from such monsters.
Right.
Yeah, overall, my impression of this movie... it's really intense.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really tense movie. Like, once the sort of action starts, it doesn't really let up till the very end. And I think John Krasinski does really well with directing that tension because holy shit, there were times like I couldn't breathe through like the second half of the movie, basically, because sort of keeps happening. Almost to the point where it's like, come on, give them a break. but I think the movie would have been much less effective if they had a break. I think the story itself is pretty pulpy. And there's not really much there, literally, as far as a script. It must have all just been descriptions of action, because there's very little dialogue, which is fine. I felt like the story could have been very bad very easily. But I feel like John Krasinski actually, I think he did a really good job of focusing on the tension so that we don't notice like some of the sort of plot holes or just sort of little inconsistencies and just the general pulpy nature of it. I think the story, you know, as far as plot goes, I was kind of able to predict just about everything that would happen. So that kind of bummed me out, I guess. Just because I really dug the tone of the movie.
Right.
So, yeah, I think basically my takeaway was I think John Krasinski did a really good job of taking an okay script, a decent horror premise, and playing it for as much tension and horror as he could get out of it.
Yeah. I would agree. I think you're being a little overly critical. I don't know.
There's some stuff like the fucking monster tears through a corn silo in seconds and can't get into a truck. You know what I mean? There's like little things like that I'm like, that I noticed on the first watch, which normally I don't notice sort of plot holes like that.
The movie definitely, and now it's my big takeaway as far as criticisms go, pretty much right away, was it plays kind of fast and loose with its own rules, especially as far as what these things can and can't hear. Because there's a lot of times where, you know, the characters are just barely making a sound. There's like these little like rock chucks or whatever that like they're little like squibbling on the ground causes a monster to run from, you know, hundreds of yards away and kills it immediately.
Rock chucks? Are you talking about the fucking raccoons?
Well, they were raccoons? No, they looked like little, like, they looked like
fucking raccoons.
Hedgehogs or something.
Not
hedgehogs.
What?
Groundhogs. They look more like groundhogs.
No, they, oh my god. Okay. No, we're focusing on this for the rest of the podcast. They were clearly fucking raccoons. They were big as fuck. They were like the size of a dog. Secondly, they were on a roof. Rock chucks don't go on roofs. Thirdly, they were fucking raccoons, Cass.
I could have swore. Anyway, whatever. So some varmint of some kind.
Okay. All right. So take the rest of Cassidy's review with that kind of a grain of salt, where he can't even recognize a fucking raccoon.
It was a dark scene. But when they're on the ground, they're making a little bit of noise, they get killed immediately, right? You know, even like something at the very end when they're in the grain silo and just the sound of the door swinging back and forth causes these creatures to come from hundreds of yards away.
Yeah. There's a
they can run from one side of their field to the other side of their field and not get noticed by the sound of their feet hitting the ground or the sound of like them, you know, heavy breathing. So there are a lot of times when you really like, if you try to follow the logic of the movie, you try to follow their own rules that they're setting up. There's a lot of times you go, pretty sure that would be pretty loud.
Well, so I agree. But also take into account that there are only three in the area, and right. we don't really know the kind of range they have. We presume it's pretty large.
Yeah.
But, you know, it could just be they were nearby when the raccoons walked. You know what I mean?
So right, yeah.
Like, they heard them on the...
there's some sequences towards the end when we know they're in proximity, when the characters are running, you know, full speed and, yes. you know, things yeah. like that. So, it's one of those things, if you look at it hard enough, it kind of falls apart.
Yeah, yeah. But I just mean that I did notice that a little more than I normally do on a first watching.
Right, because the movie is very, or the premise, I should say, not the movie really, but the premise
is so specific.
Is so specific, and you're talking about creatures that have rules, so that puts that in your head from the beginning, and
yeah.
you start kind of like the movie It Follows.
Yeah,
that's another yeah. movie in which the entity or whatever you want to call it, it sets up something that you're going to be looking for the rest of the movie. Now, I think It follows its own logic pretty well.
I think it
but I've yes. heard some people complain about that as well. But
I think that they aren't looking into the rules enough. I actually think with It Follows, it's really fucking smart how it deals with its rules and it doesn't even explain them all to you, but they seem pretty mm-hmm. clear if you watch it a few times.
Sure.
What's going on.
Yeah, no, yeah, I love that movie. I think this is a pretty good movie though. And yes, it's pulpy.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, it's so kind of
getting my criticisms out of the gate. Because overall, I thought this movie was really fucking tense.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it had me on the edge of my seat. And I genuinely did care about the characters. You know, I wanted yes. them to succeed. And overall, the tone of the movie was really fucking cool.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an ambitious movie.
It takes a huge risk in that it's a movie that's, you know, for the most part, very, very silent. I mean, there's... almost, there's maybe a page of spoken dialogue in the entire thing. It's a mm-hmm. wordless film, other than what we're seeing captioned when they're sign language
and the very
speaking to each other. And the sound design itself is very, very minimal.
And the the sound design is minimal, but it uses what it does really
very
well.
Purposeful. Yeah,
yeah. Like, so like, there's
he knows when to crank it up, or if it makes it so that when sound does occur, it's all the more impactful. You're very, very aware of sound as you're watching it.
I was worried going into this movie that it was going to be one of those movies that tries to scare me by being loud. Mm-hmm. Like there's a pretty typical trope with like a lot of ghost movies and stuff,
right?
Where it's like a character walking in a dark room, and then there's something behind them, and all of a sudden there's just like loud noise.
Yeah, booga booga booga.
Yeah, and so yeah. I was afraid that there was going to be a lot of that in this movie because it's so focused on sound, but I was impressed with how restrained that was.
And by how restrained the direction is, you know.
Yeah.
This is not a movie that, I mean, it is a pulpy premise, but it takes that premise fairly seriously, even when
I think John Krasinski does a really good job of making this threat real and making these creatures scary and intense, where in the hands of another director, I think it could have been really pulpy and cheesy and a lot less scary.
Yeah, but I think, you know, part of the reason why it works so well is that it's a monster movie that's not about the monsters.
Yes.
It is primarily about this family, and they, given the fact that the screenplay gives them so little to say to each other, we mm-hmm. do get to know them all pretty well, and they all have pretty distinct personalities, and even like the kids and stuff all have a stake in the plot itself. It's not just, they're not just there to be monster fodder or there to be, you know,
annoying,
to be precious or to be, a plot point in the sense of like, we got to rescue or blah, blah, blah. Like, all of them have agency in the story.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I think that is a skill in the screenwriting as well as in the performances.
Yeah, that's a fair point. So I can see that.
For me, the overwhelming positives of the movie on a cinematic level, because I think this is, especially since we're stripping away dialogue and things like that, this is more of a cinematic experience than it is a literary one, obviously.
For sure.
And I think that on that level, it really works. And it really, really works as a fun genre experience as well.
Yeah, no, I was surprised how much it sort of reminded me of the first Alien movie.
Yeah, I thought about that. Especially one sequence in particular. I'm sure you know which one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there were, along those lines, there were a couple moments where I almost wanted it to lean into the pulp a little more. There's one specific moment that I don't want to say because it's a pretty big deal.
Mm-hmm.
I think you might know what I'm talking about.
Possibly.
It's at the truck.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Where I wanted sort of that sort of pulpy hero moment, if that makes sense.
Right.
And we get that, but I want it a little different, which is, you know, that's sort of on me. I think that
sequence, it is a fun kind of monster attack sequence, and it has shades of like,
I don't know how to say
Jeep sequence in Jurassic Park. So I was reminded a little bit of that, but also
I can see that.
But also, I think that that's a huge character moment.
Oh, for sure. There was something very specific I wanted from that I didn't get. But that doesn't mean it was a bad moment. Like, what I got was still good, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the last shot of the movie is...
Oh, yeah, yeah. It ends on a perfect note.
Yeah, I think so, too. And a fun kind of wink at the camera sort of moment as well.
Yeah. Yeah, so you're right. I mean, there are moments like that. There was just a couple that I was like, that would have been kind of fun in a movie that's, I wouldn't really describe as fun.
I would. You know what I mean? I actually had a blast at this movie. I think, you know, the tone is somber, for sure. But to me, you know, the monster movie premise stuff of it, I'm still able to get into in a big genre way. Especially when you see the creatures, they look like these giant kind of like, I don't know, they kind of look like a cross between the Lickers from Resident Evil and the giant praying mantis. Original design as far as
goes. Since we got there organically, I do want to talk about the creature design. They weren't bad.
Mm-hmm.
I dug them during the movie. They didn't like take me out of the movie. They sort of looked like sort of reminded me of like Carnage.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah,
but like their faces kind of had this sort of mm-hmm. Carnage look to them. But yeah, like sort of insect like. But I wanted them to. And this again, this is just sort of my expectation versus what I got. They look a little on the generic side.
Sure.
They look a little Demigorgon-ish, mm-hmm. A little just sort of modern monster movie. And I wanted them to have like kind of a bat face. Like I kind of wanted them to be giant bats because, you know, they're hunting with sound and like, I just expected them to have, like, big fucking ears, because that would make sense, right?
They do, technically. There is, like, we see these shots of them opening their ears, and it's kind of gruesome, but... I agree with you. I the monster design is not particularly creative, but I think it gets the job done.
Yes. Yeah, I can't... I'm not going to say they're bad monsters, because they are scary, they are... you know, brutal, giant hulking things. But yeah, I just, I think they could have just been a little more
specific.
Yeah, and that could have been like, you know, like they could have been really well designed, and it could have been like a famous movie monster almost, because they are such a, I don't know, they are so specific in the way that they hunt and sort of the ramifications of this world.
Yeah,
that I think just a little more, I don't know, something with their creature design could have, like, they could have gone from a pretty good monster to easily like great fucking one of the cinema great movie monsters.
Yeah. No, I know exactly what you're saying. I did think like the CG, because they're mostly computer animated, I think there might have been a little puppetry in some of the close ups, but I think the CG like totally works and is because given that they're the only thing in the movie pretty much that's animated, the rest of the movie is very, very naturalistic and very earthy. You know, it's all a lot of outdoor shots.
When they kind of
a lot of wide shots in the movie, it's even though it's kind of a chamber piece, it does feel very open.
Yeah. When they do the kind of close-ups on the monster's ears, you could tell they were a little more CGI then. But yeah, for the most part, they feel like pretty weighty and real.
They're in this sharing the space with the characters. So I think in that sense, the design works. But I agree with you in general. It's not very specific. Like, if you were to tell me right now to draw it, it would be an approximation. It wouldn't be.
Yeah. Close. And exactly. And that's just sort of how I felt about this movie in general, where it was like, I felt like it was really good, but there were just a few little things holding it back from being like fucking amazing. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I don't know.
No, I get that a little bit. Like, I'm not like, I don't want to let it go for some of its inconsistencies, but I think what it does right is so great.
Yes, and honestly,
it at very least is worthy of a name check. If you're talking about movies like Alien or The Descent or Signs or other movies sort of in this ballpark, I think it certainly deserves a name check next to those.
Yeah, I agree. And again, I'm being really sort of nitpicky with my criticism. I enjoyed the movie. Like I said, it, like, I was surprised Ashley wanted to go see it, because she, you know, heard it got good reviews and stuff. Mm-hmm. And we came out of it and I was like, we were just both like, you didn't want to talk about it because you didn't want to make, I didn't want to make noise.
I like, was surprised at how quiet my theater was and remained so.
Yeah. But
they were totally there was invested.
Like, there was like one jump scare where a girl screamed and everyone kind of giggled. But you know, for the most part, everyone was really quiet and respectful. And a movie like this, if you see it with a shitty audience, it could just ruin the whole thing.
Yeah, for you. I would think so. But I was surprised too, because when I got into my theater, there's like cell phones happening all over the place, a very young audience. This did very well, which is cool also, because it's an original premise on a kind of mid-budget movie.
And honestly, we don't get a lot of creature features like this anymore.
Not unless it's like a big franchise like Alien Covenant or something like that.
Yeah, but just like a standalone,
yeah, little horror film.
Yeah.
I think people, there's like something of a horror renaissance kind of happening right now. Like, people aren't like talking about it too much because I think they're afraid they'll scare it away if they talk about it too much. But in the last few years, there's been a lot of gems. Usually around this time of the year, you know, It Follows being one of them, The Witch being another.
Yeah, and it's like they save all the not good ones for October, which is insane.
Or they don't do it at all, which is even weirder. I've noticed a lot of October has been weirdly barren on the horror front, as far as out of the theaters. But yeah, no, I enjoy this movie a lot. I think it's definitely a theater experience. I think you could watch it at home on a big screen and get something out of it, but you're going to probably want to pause it or answer the door, or answer your phone or whatever. I think if you see it in a theater, it's a unique sort of cinematic experience.
I agree. I think it's, I mean, for the most part, it's cool and original and Yeah, you're right. I said it wasn't fun, but that's more just like it has kind of a dour tone. Mm-hmm. It's so fucking intense, though. Like, I don't think we talked enough about just
yeah, you're clenched for a good 40 minutes straight.
Yeah, that is something that really stood out to me, was sort of the unrelenting pace of, like, once the action starts, it's just like, mm-hmm. fuck me, like, I can't but even breathe. But
it's
not like
a fill the screen with junk at you kind of action. Like, it's very, like, he's you know, turning those screws very, very tightly, and yeah. he knows exactly which ones to turn to keep the momentum going.
One more slight criticism I have,
okay,
is I feel like we as the audience figured out sort of how the defeat of the monsters,
yeah,
sooner than we needed to.
Maybe, yeah, I think that they drop a few hints along the way that maybe hold our hand a little bit. This is a commercial film,
yeah, and I think But that being said, I feel like the movie does deal with exposition pretty well. Like, all we get to know this world is just like newspapers that are scattered around and mm-hmm. like a whiteboard on the wall that sort of lays these creatures out. But other than that, like, the characters don't ever talk about it.
Right, yeah, we get a couple headlines and stuff like that, but I wouldn't want that. I wouldn't want, like, you know.
No, I think that was really cool, and that's
or something like that.
That's why it was a little frustrating how much it felt like they needed to point this weakness out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, because I felt like the movie dealt with exposition so well in every other aspect, mm-hmm. except for the monster's kryptonite, which I was like, oh, okay, like.
But what's cool about that, even though. And I think that this kind of plays into the pulpy nature, mm-hmm. in a good way, is that it's thematic. You know, it's not just yes. like at the end of Signs where it's like, oh, water, okay.
Yeah, water for no reason kills them. Yeah, it builds, there's a reason for it. Everything is, even if they don't follow all their own rules mm-hmm. 100% of the time, everything feels pretty logical.
Mm-hmm. Or at the very least, considered.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I like this movie quite a bit. I'm going to give it a B+.
Yeah, that was actually the same grade I gave it.
Okay, all right.
But that's what was frustrating, is I felt like it was just short of an A.
Just shy of an A, yeah. Just, you know, a couple things here or there, or at the very least, some unanswered questions.
We also didn't talk about, like, the performances at all, you know, like, how...
Think everyone's great.
Yeah, to convey the amount of emotion and connectiveness mm-hmm. that they do using no dialogue
mm-hmm.
Is really cool. I think this is probably the best I've seen John Krasinski, and Emily Blunt is always amazing.
She's great. She's a fucking treasure.
She is. Have you heard? So after this, like, in one of the press junkets, mm-hmm. John Krasinski was talking about how he would like to play Mr. Fantastic. And if
I did hear
Marvel,
that.
Yeah, if Marvel does a reboot and have Emily Blunt as the Invisible Woman. And I'm like, okay with John Krasinski, but Emily Blunt as the Invisible Woman is so fucking good.
Mm-hmm.
And their chemistry together in this movie, I mean, it doesn't hurt that they're actually married.
Right.
But they're just... They play off of each other so well. Yeah, mm-hmm. she's so fucking good.
And, I mean, this goes against kind of the John Krasinski narrative, I feel, in a lot of ways. Because everyone pretty much knows him as Jim Halpert from The Office. This kind of smart-alecky thing. And then lately he's done a lot of action movies.
He was trying to do this sort of action thing.
Yeah, did you read that story about him trying out for Captain America? And once he had the costume on, he said, I'm not Captain America.
I could see him as more of like a Reed Richards type.
I don't know if he's as nerdy for that, but
I just think it's cute if they did it together
for sure. But I think you know, a lot of people, when I think of, anyways, when I think of an actor turned director and then does like his first couple movies, mm-hmm. I usually think of kind of actory screenplays.
Yeah.
You know, these things that, that have a lot of big emotions to play.
Or like have quirky characters. And, yeah.
Yeah, or just, yeah, kind of obnoxious movies that are a little up their own ass. And this is not that at all.
Yeah, and also, I
mean, it, there is a lot of performance required for it, so it is, it does play to the strengths of an actor, but I think it's not like the typical.
It's not. Thing. It doesn't feel pretentious. No.
Right.
It feels like he just wanted to make the best horror movie he could make,
and is clearly a fan of the genre, which is not something I would have thought either. But
well, apparently he's not. Apparently he wasn't. At least before this, he wasn't really a fan of horror movies. And then when he, I was reading an interview or whatever, and when he got this job to direct, he actually went back and started like watching all these old horror greats. Mm-hmm. And I think he's got to have developed some sort of love or appreciation of them.
Yeah,
apparently he's not like a horror hound or anything.
Okay, well, that's interesting, because the movie does seem very cine literate as far as its references and sort of, you know, some of the
ways certain scenes
play out.
I think that might be why it is good, though, is because, you know, because of that, he's sort of unshackled from having to make a horror, and, you know, air quotes, a horror movie. Right. And he's just sort of trying to make the best movie he can.
Genre expectations.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, yeah. The last thing I'll say about this before we move on is I feel like this is also the movie that everyone wanted It Comes at Night to be.
Oh,
which,
okay.
Which was a movie I liked, but practically nobody else did. It was a little too withholding. But yeah.
All right.
I definitely recommend it.
Yeah, yeah. I recommend seeing it in theaters, like you said.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's go ahead and move on to Girlfriend's Day, and I'll let you set that up.
All right. There is a greeting card writer who is down on his luck. He's a divorced greeting card writer. His wife had an affair on him, and he specifically used to write romance cards, and he was sort of a rock star of the romance card community right. until his wife cheated on him, and then he lost his
mojo,
his feelings, so he wasn't able to write good cards anymore, so he gets fired. He's just sort of a schlub now. And then the city decides to create a new holiday called Girlfriend's Day, and there is this massive cash prize for whoever writes the best Girlfriend's Day card, but it's excluded to amateurs or ex-professionals, conveniently. And all of these various parties try to motivate him to get his mojo back, to write the best Girlfriend's Day card. And there's murder and intrigue and plot twists.
A lot of interested parties, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. I feel like this was sort of the exact opposite of the last movie we just talked about. in that I liked a lot of the script stuff, but I think the direction of it was kind of a little heavy hand. I don't know. It had moments. I will say it had moments. I liked the world of this movie. I liked the idea that these greeting card writers are sort of this, like, different, like, alternate reality versions of, like, the beat poets.
Right.
Like, Jack Kerouac and Bukowski and the very, like, writerly community, but set in sort of the dumbest, most kitsch industry.
Right.
And I felt like that was like sort of the skeleton of this. And yeah,
there's sort of a tortured artist thing going on in the movie.
And they stretched into a whole movie, and I don't know, that, you know, maybe it would have been better as a, just a sketch. I don't know. Yeah, because, I mean, it has, I don't know, there were times when I really liked it, but then there were times when it's sort of an all-over-the-place mess.
For sure. Okay, so I think the movie is bad, largely. I guess it's a comedy. I don't think I laughed once, literally ever. I mean, it's an hour and 10 minutes, which is the best thing about it. It's forgivingly short, but it's uses absolutely no economy with that time as far as the storytelling goes. The movie is weird about the way it doles out information. In that 40 minutes in, I'm still not sure what the movie's about.
Yeah.
I have no idea what the stakes of the plot are. And then all of a sudden there's murders and, you know, hitmen and all this stuff starts happening. I feel like
And I don't know why that murder didn't happen in like the first 10 reel. Minutes.
Yeah. And I feel like this movie really, really, really wants to be a Coen Brothers movie. I'm getting, like, strong Barton Fink and Big Lebowski vibes off of this. There's obviously sort of a Raymond Chandler-esque private detective-ish narrative going on in the movie.
Well, that's what I mean when I...
But that even that element of it, which seems to be, like, a really, like, they... become stronger and stronger as you watch it. Even that element is kind of not apparent until it's too late.
Yeah, and then the end, it resolves so obnoxiously quickly. And leaves so much sort of like dangling that is just like, well, I guess that's not a problem anymore.
Yeah.
And so that was frustrating, that it spends all this time building to nothing. Yeah, and that's what I mean when I say, like...
lies there.
Yeah, yeah. And then even that has, like, no consequences. I thought some stuff was funny. I thought tonally it was funny. Like I said, I think this... the problem with it, it was sort of so high concept that... I think the director didn't really know what to do with that.
No, absolutely. There, like I said, it's... I get... sort of the surrealist vibes of something like a Barton Fink, or even like David Cronenberg's Naked Lunch, which deals exclusively with the beat poets of the time. There's like, you could tell he's seen those movies, like, oh, I could do a little this, I could do a little that, but it to without any kind of budget or any sense of style, and it just doesn't come together ever. The only thing we have really anchoring us in this kind of nothingness of a movie is following Bob Odenkirk. But we've kind of seen him do this elsewhere better. We've already seen him do this in, like, Better Call Saul or Breaking Bad. It's a very similar character, this kind of unlikable schlub. But without any kind of stakes into any kind of narrative that is at all interesting... I guess I kind of think Amber Tamblyn is, she puts off a cool vibe, but with to no effect. Stacey Keach is a terrific actor who's being completely wasted in the movie.
I thought he was, yeah, I mean, look, I don't disagree with any of the things you're saying. And if we're going to talk about people that are wasted, Natasha Lyonne?
Yeah, shows up for one scene. Like, I feel like this movie got butchered. Like, the fact that it's an hour 5 minutes is already suspect enough.
That's what I mean. I feel like it... on paper, I liked a lot of... I liked a lot of the ideas that were there. I just felt like they... I don't know if it was in the editing or if the script just needed like another pass or what. But this movie was sort of frustrating to me because I I did see that potential of sort of a, like you said, a Coen Brothers, like a Diet Coen Brothers adventure. But it just...
But it's not just funny.
There wasn't enough grounding it. It was like there were too many ideas that we couldn't focus on.
Like, I literally kept thinking, like, every, like, 15 minutes, I was like, oh, this is what the movie's about. Like, at one point, he's like,
yeah, exactly,
care of a kid. And I'm like, oh, okay, so it's going to be a movie about him, like, getting his humanity back through taking care of a kid. Oh, nope, never mind, it's not that. That was just a random element thrown in for no reason. And then it's like, oh, he, there's this interesting girl, and he's going to, like, find blah, blah, blah. Nah, not really. And
yeah, and just at that kept point,
happening over and over again.
At that point, I thought it was like, he was like just in a, like, completely dreaming or something.
Right. Yeah.
The movie, because things were so surreal.
Yeah. The movie doesn't.
And there was nothing really. No, and there was nothing really grounding it. And I get that it was supposed to sort of build to a twist, but there's there's no clues. So that, you know what I mean? There's no clues that this twist is going to happen. So it feels really cheap.
Yeah. I didn't know that there, I should even be looking for a twist. I just didn't know what the movie was.
Yeah.
Until like the last 15 minutes. I'm like, oh,
yeah. Well, that's why, like, get this, you know, I thought the first scene with him, like, getting fired was pretty fun. And then from there, I think the movie sort of loses control on its own momentum. Like, boom, right after that, we should have established this girlfriend's day and this competition and introduce us to all the parties that are trying to use him. Because it's like he's getting used, but we don't even know by who or know why or care.
Yeah. And there's a way you can play that kind of, that kind of absurdity and mystery. Obviously, you know, a movie like The Big Lebowski, like, totally is fueled on that.
Yeah, but we at least know the parties involved.
Right.
Like, we don't even see Stacy Keach till the very end.
Right. Or the 40-minute mark, which is almost the end.
Yeah. It felt like the end.
Yeah. So, yeah, I can't abide.
I mean, I don't know. I feel like you could do worse on a streaming thing. Like, if you're into that sort of thing and you're just hungry for something like it, but you don't want to watch The Big Lebowski again,
No.
But I would just say, just watch The Big Lebowski again.
I would for sure say that. I would say, you know, there's even, like, mini Coen Brothers out there that are much better than this. No, I think this is pretty much a lifeless dead dog of a movie. I don't think this is really quality at all. All it does is remind me of the movies it's trying to be. You know, what I say about a lot of these kind of things, it's like, I could excuse all of the messy narrative stuff if it were just funny, and it just isn't.
I mean, it's not like, okay, it's not, it's definitely not like laugh out loud funny. It's definitely, it's more quirky. But even that, I think, could have been played up. I think there's some clever, funny stuff in the script, but it just got buried under.
I think there's a lot of attempts at clever, funny stuff, but I think it comes off as really self-conscious and kind of twee and obnoxious.
I don't know. I think it probably read better on the page than possibly what we saw.
Possibly. All right. Well, that's that. And next week, I'm going to have us watch for the Netflix homework a Disney, dare I say, classic that I've never seen. I don't think either of us have seen. An extremely goofy movie, the direct-to-DVD sequel to a goofy movie.
If this ruins a goofy movie for me, you're going to have to fucking answer for that.
Maybe. So that's the show. If anybody has anything to say about any of the things we discussed in this episode or in future episodes, you can email us at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can leave us a voice message, record it on your phone or something like that. Send me a WAV file. I can plug it into the show. Any hot takes. And if anybody wants to find the show, you can do so from our regular archives at jabberinthedrone.podbean.com, or you can also find it streaming on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Pocket Cast, the Windows Podcast Network, Player.fm, and Google Play. You can read my reviews that I do weekly for the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. I usually post a streaming link to the episodes underneath my reviews if I have a corresponding review. You can follow us on Twitter at Jabber Podcast and Instagram at Jabber Podcast, and on Facebook at facebook.com/Jabber Podcast. Where do people find you, Keith?
You can follow me on Twitter at Keith Foster Kid, on Instagram at Keith Foster Kid. Go to my website, www.keithfosterkid.com. And I've got some shoes coming up. I think I can talk about this. I just joined a new improv show at Old Town Improv Company called Book Club. Mm-hmm. And it's twice a month. And what we do is we take a different book genre every month, and we improvise a novel in front of your very eyes. Last month they did murder mysteries. This month we're doing fairy tales. So you can see my debut with Book Club this Saturday, April 14th, at Old Town Actors, or that's a Pocatello Theater, Old Town Improv Company. In Old Town San Diego. I think it's at 9 o'clock. So it's a little later. And then later this month, I'm going to be at the Comedy Palace. On April 27th, I'm going to be doing a show there, doing some stand-up. And then I'll have another book club show on the 28th. And then I'll have a couple other improv shows. With my other troupe, Slack to the Future, on May 1st and May 3rd. And there's more detailed information on my calendar on my website. So if you're interested, go to www.keithfosterkid.com and check those out.
Nice. Be sure to listen to our friends who are also recording podcasts of their own. Rod and Denise over at The Listening Party. Although lately it's kind of been Rod and Guest. They just did an episode with that motherfucker Jody B, and that guy is entertaining. That guy he knows how to record a podcast. He's a good podcaster. They did a really fun episode about Mark Lanegan.
It's like all you want to do is make me self-conscious about my abilities.
I'm just saying. Listening Party is great. Denise's The Mascot Diaries is done, but all the archives are still there. You can check it out. You can also check out Patrick and Dennis over at Almost Educational, and Patrick and his father at Make Dad Read Comics. Bill and Brian over at the Great Albums Podcast, and Mike Fallick over at Let's Start a Cult. And I just caught up with some old friends of mine, who I guess I'm not allowed to use their real names because they record the show under pseudonyms.
You said pseudonym really weird.
Pseudonyms. Check out the podcast Those Happy Places. I think they're about 5 episodes deep. They talk about famous rides, amusement park attractions, and sort of discuss them at length.
Well, that's kind of fun.
Mm-hmm. 2 ex-employees of Disneyland.
Oh, all right. So they get the juice.
Mm-hmm. On all the attractions. So check that out. And Keith, you have
other things? Also, while you're doing that, if your podcast queue isn't full, give a listen to Adam Connie at the Adamant Podcast. Give a listen to Campfire SHT show, Campfire Shit show, with my friend Merrill and Bo. And give a listen to the most excellent Tommy Gallen podcast. Gallen. I don't know how to pronounce your name. I'm sorry. He's a local improviser. He's a really good improviser too. And he just kind of talks with a friend about whatever. And yeah, so check those out.
All right. And that's the show.
Here's the sign out for this week.
Oh, I get it.
Yeah, I signed out.